have police photographing our license plates.
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. My guest today is Andrea Miller. Andrea Miller has been many things. We could take up half the interview talking about that, but she did run for Congress in 2008. Currently, Andrea is serving as the co-executive director of the Progressive Democrats of America, and they are involved in so many issues on behalf of all Americans and America and the planet, the healthcare system, energy, it just goes on. We can't touch on them all, but she does every single day. Welcome, Andrea Miller. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Marcello. It is always a delight.
It's same here. Let's jump right in. We haven't spoken in quite a while, but one thing that hit me a couple of months ago that you brought to my attention, first of all, the Detroit water, that is water, public water being shut off only in selected communities in Detroit, and now the United Nations inspectors have been there. Can you update us a bit on that?
Well, yes. The United Nations inspectors came to Detroit at the request of Representative John Conyers. So they came in, they looked at what was going on, because according to the United Nations, water is a human right. And in Detroit, they were shutting off water for basically people who owed as little as, we originally thought, $150. Then it turned out to be 40. And in many cases, people were home from the hospital, recovering, had very, very, very young children, and they really did not have an opportunity to make arrangements. The water shutoffs would just occur. People would show up, they would turn off the water, and they would leave. Many people have probably at least once in their life forgotten to pay a water bill. And in most communities, you get a phone call or that nice little knock on the door going, ma'am, you haven't paid your water bill, and I'm here to shut it off. That wasn't happening in Detroit. They were just showing up, going to the water turnoff, and just shutting it off, and then they'd leave.
Well, the fact that the United Nations is coming into any American city and inspecting something because the United Nations, as an organization, feels that America is not living up to health standards. Instead of blaming the UN, maybe we better look at what we're doing in Detroit and other cities, by the way. Of course, Ferguson is on mind of everyone, and Dallas, Texas is on the mind of everyone. Let's with that in mind and the clock in mind, Andrea, thank you for that answer. But About Ebola, it seems to me, as often happens in our wonderful country, the focus is being directed by certain politicians, certainly in the media, in a panic direction on let's be afraid, oh my God, we're all going to die from Ebola, as opposed to what I know you and PDA stress. This is an opportunity to reevaluate what's going on in the healthcare system, pharmaceuticals, and what drugs they make and what they don't, and where they're willing to sell them and market them and where they're not. How would, for instance, if the budget had not been cut by Congress through sequester, the NIH budget for coming up with a cure for Ebola, and how does this affect a long-time issue for PDA, and that's healthcare for all, Medicare for all, single payer? Let's look at Ebola for a couple of minutes through those lenses, could we?
We most certainly can. At the roundtable, Kim Vinn of National Nurses United explained that between 2010 and 2014, the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, and the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, had their budget cut by basically $1 billion.
Wow.
I mean, that's billion with a B. Mm. This is money that these agencies did not get to develop protocols for working with a pandemic that is literally coming in from overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at, number one, the NIH and the CDC are severely underfunded, that means that they have not completed all the clinical trials and tests for developing an Ebola vaccine. They were looking at developing a vaccine and had begun clinical trials in 2008.
Wow.
And then since 2010, their budget has been continuously and consistently cut. Now, add to that, Mr. Duncan was in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Texas is a state that refused Medicaid expansion.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that hospitals in Texas are not going to receive millions, if not billions of dollars that they would have gotten from the federal government to get themselves prepared for this disease. We're going into the flu season.
Yes.
And Ebola kind of looks like the flu to the untrained observer.
Yes.
So when we look at hospitals have basically no protocols because we've never really dealt with anything like this in modern times. Number two, 23 states have hospitals that have experienced drastic budget cuts that have A, forced them to lay off staff, and B, means they do not have money to purchase protective gear and basically fund the development of isolation units. We have 20 isolation units in the United States of America. That is 20 units for 300 million people. I don't even know how you divide that and what number you come up with. But this is currently where we sit. We know what the disease is. We know how the disease spreads. But we have zero tools to fight it. And it is all because we have wantonly and stupidly cut the budget in very bad places.
Yes.
So for all those people who don't want government, this is what no government looks like.
So a lot of the healthcare and hospitals are being affected in the states, the 23 states in particular, who have refused to accept federal money through the Affordable Care Act. Is that oversimplifying?
know that basically is very, 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 very true. And again, since so many of these hospitals are in southern states, many of the hospitals have basically gone to the governors and to the legislators, and they have tried to explain that we are coming up on flu season. And this was even before we had to deal with Ebola.
Uh-huh.
And we have so many people who are unemployed and underemployed, and then fallen into the coverage gap.
Yes.
People are going to be getting the flu, and they're not going to be able to go to the doctor and basically treat it. And the flu is one of those diseases where realistically, most people are not going to be able to self-medicate, especially if you are already with a compromised system. Say you're elderly, say you're very young, say you have lung issues or heart issues already. So this is what we're looking at. It is an incredible situation.
Well, I want to just mention this before I ask the next question, that there are many private hospitals these days, and the private hospitals, or to the private hospitals, the CDC's recommendations are just guidelines. Now, that's in the process of being changed, we hope, but the private hospital, such as the Texas Presbyterian in Dallas, doesn't have to follow what the CDC says. It's just a guideline. It's not a rule, and until that changes, that's a fact. But my question is about the uninsured, because there are states, these 23 states, who are refusing the federal money to expand Medicaid. We even have that issue going on in Virginia. How many people are estimated to die in a year because they're simply without insurance? There's a number on that.
I know the numbers for Virginia, and I know Virginia is 600.
Yes.
I think when I last saw a total, it is somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 14,000.
Yes.
And again, these are people who are going to die who didn't have to die.
Yes.
They're going to get sick. They're not going to be able to afford care, and therefore, they're going to die. Why is getting sick in America equal a death sentence?
And with the exactly, and with the scare that I'm not saying one should be foolhardy about Ebola or flu or any other disease, but the scare, the mania, the panic over Ebola, rather than making us run toward health care and the Affordable Care Act, it's making people afraid. Those who don't have insurance, you know, as is often accused, would go to the emergency room. That was their way of getting health care. But now they'll be afraid to go to the emergency room.
Yes, because we never know where someone who has Ebola symptoms may enter the hospital. And again, people may simply think, oh, darn, I've got the flu, so I'm going to just grit my teeth and, you know, try to buy over-the-counter medications, and or worse yet, if they are employed, I'm going to just try to keep on dragging myself to work. And then what if these people work in food service, which so many of our minimum wage people do?
Yes.
They work in food service for fast food companies.
All right, we're going to shift gears just because there is so much I'd like to talk to you about. There's fracking, there's Ferguson. There may even be a connection between the two, but what about Ferguson? It doesn't seem to be going away. I know we sort of blame the police and the Pentagon for arming the police, but that's not the whole story. There are things that are still going on in the police department in Ferguson, Missouri, that people are still rightfully, understandably protesting. What's the latest from there? What's 1033 reform, for instance?
Well, 1033 reform basically says that the Pentagon in particular will stop giving things like tanks, armored vehicles, grenade launchers, weapons that fire more than 50 millimeter rounds to, you know, local police forces, because these are weapons of war. Mm. And when we look at Ferguson, you can't help feeling like, oh my goodness, am I looking at something from Baghdad, Afghanistan,
yes,
from a war zone somewhere. Now, Garland Nixon joined us at the round table on Friday, on Wednesday, and he had some very interesting things to say about the police, which I think listeners really need to hear, and that is, police don't go into a community.
Yes.
Police come out of a community.
Excellent.
So when we look at what is going on in Ferguson, we are actually looking at a community that has some very serious racial issues that were there long before this started. So nobody said that Officer Darren Wilson was using anything other than the service revolver.
Yes.
The problem is the culture of hate, the culture of discrimination that exists in Ferguson and many other places in this country really makes it right for these kinds of abuses to take place. Again, we go back and we look at Trayvon Martin, and we look at the culture and the beliefs of George Zimmerman.
Yes.
So we no longer make sure that people going into the police force do not have these deep-seated racial prejudices, fears, and hatreds. And we just can't afford to do it anymore. So basically, if you're willing and you can pass the test, hey, welcome aboard.
Yes.
So communities have to look at, number one, who we hire to be our peacekeeping force,
yes,
and what we understand it to mean and what they understand it to mean. And if it's not the same thing,
yes,
we have a problem. And again, the very specific instructions were given by the Department of Justice to the police force in Ferguson. Officers must wear their name tags when they are on duty.
Yes.
They're not wearing their name tags.
Yes.
Officers must not wear wristbands that say, I am Darren Wilson.
Yes.
Basically inciting the community and, you know, very, you know, blatant saying, hey, we are against you. Not, we are here to protect and support your community. We are standing against this community. All those things are still happening, so nothing in the culture of Ferguson has changed.
Yes.
Ferguson is not over. Ferguson is not going away.
Yes. All right. For, before we go, I do want to talk a bit about fracking, because the seems the Federal Energy Regulation Commission has sort of adopted an attitude that there's such thing as clean fracking. And the opposite point of view is keep fossil fuels in the ground and remake the energy system. So let's tell them what fracking is, and then we'll go from there.
Well, normally what happens with regular fracking is companies that are going to frack concoct a combination of chemicals which are basically toxic.
Yes.
And then they shoot them down into the ground, and they go down through the ground, they go down through the layer of water that is normally there, and they go all the way down to where the pool of either oil or basically normally to natural gas pockets happen to be.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're looking at traditional cracking, when toxic chemicals go through water, the water becomes poisoned. So what they're saying now is, oh, we've invented clean chemicals where they don't poison the water.
Mm.
Well, these new clean chemicals have turned out to be just as bad, if not worse, than the other chemicals, because they're actually poisoning the people that are handling them.
Okay.
And again, we do have to go back to your initial statement. Certain amount of fossil fuels really must remain in the ground.
Yes.
We all grew up hearing the term the balance of nature.
Yes.
Well, we remove too much fossil fuel from under the ground, we upset the balance of nature.
Yes.
And upsetting Mother Nature is never a good thing. The other thing that happens with fracking is because we go down into, sometimes through the plates, fracking causes earthquakes.
Yes.
Areas in Ohio that never had earthquakes before, but what they've discovered is in the areas where they are doing intense fracking, they're now having earthquakes.
So that makes them mandatory to buy earthquake insurance for the first time in their lives.
Well, yes, but then the other thing that becomes very interesting is at some point, insurance companies who really are risk adverse,
yes,
and they like selling people products, but only if they don't have to pay, if this continues on and there continue to be problems, and generally when you start a cycle of earthquakes, they're going to continue and get worse.
Yes.
What will happen is the insurance company will simply say, we're not honoring any more of the policies.
Yes.
And so you're on your own.
Kind of like Walmart saying, we're not doing health care benefits anymore. I'm so sorry.
Right.
We have to stop. I think the overall point I'm getting from this interview with you, Andrea, is that we are still, like the doctors in the healthcare system, addressing symptoms rather than getting to the core of the problem, whether it's Ferguson or fracking or Ebola. We've got to get into what is the real issue, the real problem, turning around the way people think and the way they treat the global economy and the Earth's resources. It seems to me that that's the overall point we've gotten to here. To me, anyway, we've got to recognize the real core of the issues and address them. Like Garland Nixon said, as you told us, what was his exact quote?
Basically, what he said is, that police come from the community. They don't go into the community.
That's right.
Out of the community. So whatever the beliefs and prejudices of that community are, people that are born and raised there, they grow up with those beliefs and those prejudices. And the fact that Ferguson is 86% African American, and there is a police force that is roughly 97% non-minority, that's problematic.
Yes.
In Richmond, when there are issues in a Hispanic community, you will at least have one Hispanic officer there, and the same is true if it is in a black community, and you have officers that are paired, that work together, that are able to learn from each other's culture, what is normal in that culture, and begin to erase some of our cultural fears.
Exactly. All right. We're going to have to stop, but Andrea, could you give us your website, PDA website, and where we can find out more about the various causes and events that PDA is involved in? Issues?
Thank you, Marcella. You can always find out about events that are going on at PDA by going to www.pdamerica.org. or a sister site, www.pdacommunity.org. So we have lots of information and articles on our website, and we keep them there.
Excellent.
So it has been wonderful, Marcello. I always love talking with you.
And the same here, and it's always full of information, and I know it seems like a lot to think about, but we have to start thinking about it and acting on it. Thank you so much, Andrea Miller, the co-executive director of the Progressive Democrats of America. We will be talking again soon, I trust. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Don't go away. We'll be right back with our second guest for today. Stay with us.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. One imagines that when this film was conceived, it was thought that the economy was in a brief downturn, and the events depicted, that of corporate downsizing, would be a memory upon which an interesting exploration of a particular set of humanity could be set. As tough times remained when the film was ready for release, audiences were deemed not ready for such an exploration, and it was pushed under the rug. Too bad. The Company Men uniquely sets its story within the lives of upper management. They see themselves as titans until they find that their worth was ephemeral, associated with position and place. At the center of this compelling story is Bobby Walker, played by Ben Affleck, a highly paid company man. He is his job until it no longer exists. He does not know how to be less than his corporate self, so he continues, with disaster looming, to live as if he were still an earner. This is who he is and is not anymore. The Company Men is a compelling morality tale offering a grim picture of a soulless corporation, leaving us with more questions than answers. It also offers some satisfying laughs, a ray of hope, and an examination of the relative value of those who build and those who manipulate.
Indie Film Minute, not in theaters, discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. My second guest today, Eileen Davis, a registered nurse in Richmond, Virginia. And Eileen, first of all, how are you?
I'm great, Marcello. How are you?
I'm great. Welcome to the show, and please tell us, what are you doing right now?
Well, I'm standing on the campus at Virginia Commonwealth University, talking to students with the VCU chapter of Women Matter, our group, getting enrollment and getting students interested in educating them about the lack of constitutionally guaranteed gender equality, known as the Equal Rights Amendment.
Equal Rights Amendment. Let's go right to the website, Women Matter. Tell us what that is and how we can...
It's women-matter.org and the dash matters.
Gotcha.
In terms of finding it. And what we are is we are dedicated to finishing the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment and to ratifying the International Women's Treaty, also known as CEDAW. Both of those things give women in America and women globally something we don't now have, which is constitutionally guaranteed gender equality. The International Women's Treaty would bring that worldwide. Sadly, and this is a very little known fact, there are only five countries that have not signed the International Women's Treaty, the United States being one of them, because it requires an equality clause for gender in a country's constitution, and the United States doesn't have one, so we can't and won't sign it. And if we do, that automatically backdoors an Equal Rights Amendment into our constitution.
So let us be clear for those listening that not only does registered nurse Eileen Davis say this, but also Supreme Court Justice Scalia says, in the United States Constitution, there is no provision for equality of gender. That is, women are not constitutionally equal to men. Am I overstating that, Eileen?
Well, you're not, but let me clarify.
Okay.
First of all, it's not just Scalia. It's also Ginsburg and Souter, and the other Supreme Court justices have not weighed in either way. They have failed to comment. But what Scalia said, Scalia was asked in a lecture why he did not support Lilly Ledbetter's claim before the Supreme Court by a law school student. And, of course, he went on to Congress
and they had to deal with it that way. And he said, and I'm pretty close to quoting, but if I miss a word or two, I'll call it a paraphrase.
Okay.
He stated, the Constitution does not prohibit a discrimination based on gender. I was under no constitutional obligation to do so. And also, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in just last week's Huffington Post, did an interview where she talked about how she's concerned that today's modern-day feminists don't seem to care that they are not guaranteed under constitutional law gender equality. And she said that she's afraid that today's modern-day feminists will take for granted the rights they do have, because the rights that we have on intermediate law, they are not constitutionally supported. So she made a really big splash, and it was also was covered in the second page of last week's Newsweek, the quote that she said that. And then she goes on to talk about how she wanted the Equal Rights Amendment to pass, and was saddened that it went into timeout 30 years ago because it fell short of the three states. And my statement, which I'm talking to students about,
yes,
is talking to them about what Justice Ginsburg said, but stating to them, not that you don't care, simply you don't know.
Yes.
You know, people, 72% of the country thinks that gender equality is already enshrined, that equality of gender is already enshrined in the Constitution. 97.7% think that we should have it. So what we're really dealing with here is an education curve, not a disagreement on whether or not it's appropriate.
Exactly. Although women still are not paid the same as men for the same amount of work, and that can break down racially.
Oh, yes. It's 77 cents on the dollar if you're Caucasian, and 67 if you're African-American, and even lower than that if you're Latina.
Yes.
But it's interesting that's the other thing. We're all into the Equal Pay Act and all these other things. Those bills are all important, and they're all well and good, but it's important to remember that's just another intermediate law.
Mm.
When the Equal Rights Amendment went into a stall 30 years ago, there was a lot of people that, were just kind of saddened that we didn't get it, so they gave us some kind of consolation prizes in the form of a lot of little incremental laws. And these incremental laws have, to some degree, hurt us because they've given the false idea that the problem has been solved by these incremental laws. But it has not, because we still don't have the constitutional protection. And as we know from other issues, constitutional protection is the strict scrutiny of the Constitution is the basement on which all these other laws sit. And without it, the laws are nails without a hammer. They're kind of toothless.
Exactly.
Which is why, even though we have all these laws, we have very weak enforcement.
So to be clear, Congress did pass the Equal Rights Amendment in the 70s, but
yes,
the states have to ratify any amendment to the Constitution, and we are three states short. That's where we are. What is the status of the congressional bills, SJ Res 15 and SJ Res 113?
Well, that's the thing. We have bills in Congress right now to remove the ratification deadline. We have constitutional precedent for that. We have what we're saying, and we have precedent is a couple of things. Congress has, had the right to impose a deadline. They have the right to remove a deadline. And it's important to know that the deadline was added to the cover page of the amendment. It was not part of the amendment that Congress actually voted on.
Uh-huh.
It was added on, interestingly enough, by a Republican. It's important to remember that the Equal Rights Amendment started out as a Republican bill,
yes,
which is another thing that we need to really kind of think about when we think about what Thomas Jefferson called the vagaries of politics.
Yes.
We in one generation have completely flipped around, and the only thing that's constant and unchanging is the Constitution. So unless we're in the Constitution with full guaranteed equality of gender, then, we're at the whims of whatever generation we're dealing with. And
yes,
it's also interesting that Equal Rights Amendment, resistance to it has mirrored its generation of origin. I mean, in the 1800s, women were relegated to perpetual guardianship by their male family members, and that was their reason for not giving women any rights. And then in the 20s, up to World War II, it was, we gave you the vote, that's enough. And then, in the 1950s and 60s, females still could not have their own credit. They couldn't sign a mortgage. They couldn't serve on a jury. The Mad Men culture was in place, which always puzzled me, because how would I, as a female, have had a jury of my peers at that point in time?
Good point.
And then in the 70s, resistance was built around the draft. It was built around unisex bathrooms. It was built around fear of the female clergy and women losing femininity. That was the reason stated. The reason has always been an economic one. Paying women less is a cheap labor force. That's where the true resistance comes from.
Where does that leave us in Illinois? I know there's a pending...
So that's the thing. When I talk to people about this issue, they look at me and they go, well, isn't that like a 30-year-old thing? Why are we still talking about it? Well, because it's not a 30-year-old thing. We you know, we're back at it. We're back at it hard. We have bills in Congress, as you mentioned,
yes.
SJ Res 15 and House Joint Res 113, which calls for the removal of the ratification deadline completely within the purview of Congress, which will allow us to pursue the three remaining states that we need.
Uh-huh.
And interesting, your listeners in Virginia need to know, Virginia is one of those three states that we need and one of the states that we're working very hard to ratify.
Yes.
What you're talking about is Illinois. Illinois is extremely close to ratifying. We passed in the Illinois Senate. We're a handful, and I mean less than a handful, of votes away from ratifying it in their House of Delegates. And we go before a veto session in November, which will address that. And it's highly likely that by the end of the year, we will have our 36th ratified state by the state of Illinois being that state.
Wow.
And then when that happens, we're going to go into January session and saying to the Virginia legislators who passed it bipartisan support in the Virginia Senate but did not pass it in the Virginia legislature because they said they won't take it to the floor until the ratification deadline is lifted. So we will be able to go back in January and say, Virginia, Illinois just ratified. Are you going to join the modern era, or are you going to be, you know, the state that holds everyone back?
You know, it's been disappointing to me. You know, I know you live in Virginia, too, but I haven't lived in Virginia all my life, only in the last 5 to 6 years or so. And some of the things that have come out of the Virginia General Assembly, and I know many members in Richmond in the Assembly, and I just don't, I mean, the ones I know are the good guys, but, you know, but I just don't know how one can still look at their wives and mothers and sisters and aunts and not fight for them.
Interesting, Marcello. What happened when we went before the Virginia General Assembly last year, we went before the Senate, and Senator Henry Marsh, who has since resigned, you know, he took this bill on, and he took it on because he agreed with us.
Yes.
Gender equality in our Constitution is the last unfinished civil rights issue of the modern time.
Yes.
You know, we've now resolved marriage equality and the rights of same-sex couples, et cetera, et cetera. You know, women's equality under constitutional law is the last civil rights issue of our modern time. Once we can finish this, we have addressed all of the groups in this country that are not protected by law for different things. Women are the last big one. And I don't like to call this the women's issue because we're not a niche. We're not a save the whale special interest group.
Yeah.
We're actually the majority population. So, you know, Henry Marsh told the Virginia Senate that this is the last civil rights issue of the modern era, and that nothing that they would do in their Virginia Senate career would ever be more monumental than this single vote because it will touch more lives than anything else they would ever do.
And more Americans, for that matter.
Right.
Women outnumber us. You know, it's like, what are we waiting for? I have to say, too, for those who don't, you know, I hear people say, well, what do you mean women already get what they want? Well, that, of course, is not true either, and not legally or morally. But I'd like to point out that, like anything, the law of the land, the Constitution is what protects you. Things that are privileges, which is what people get confused. Driving is a privilege. Voting is a privilege. Women getting unequitable salaries evidently is a privilege of corporations or of men. But the point is, we're fighting for ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, because once it's an amendment to the Constitution, it is the law of the land. It's not just a privilege that can be taken away like driving or voting.
Exactly. And, you know, our attitude is when men say, well, women, there are some women that are against us.
Yes,
they're like, well, women, how do we need? Well, really, you do and you don't, and maybe you do and maybe you don't, and put it in writing. Why not put it in writing?
Exactly.
Women love the Constitution, too, and we want to be in it. I mean, you know, the interesting thing is that the 14th Amendment, which is referred to as the Equality Amendment,
yes.
You know, the 14th Amendment has the word male in it three times. It says male citizen, and male inhabitant. Now, you know, they could have said citizen and inhabitant, but they didn't. They said male citizen and male inhabitant three times in explicit intent to exclude women from its protection, which is why 50-plus years later in the 19th Amendment, was done just to give women the carve-out right to vote.
Yes.
Howard Fall wrote the right to vote, the 19th Amendment. And if you look at the language of the 19th Amendment and you look at the Equal Rights Amendment, the language is exactly the same except for the switch out of four words. You know, the right to vote shall not be denied by or abridged by the United States or any other state on account of sex. That's the 19th Amendment. Equal Rights Amendment. Equality of rights shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any other state on account of sex. That's it.
Yes.
And at the time, the 19th Amendment was supposed to go into effect, and then the 20th Amendment was supposed to follow afterwards as part two. She expected it to be the 20th Amendment. Here we are 91 years later, we still haven't gotten it done.
Wow.
And
look,
it's amazing to me. It really is amazing, because I see this as a, I like puppies still. I don't see why anybody wouldn't want to correct the male-centric language of what it's called the, and they'll say to you, oh, well, it's inferred, it's implied. Well, we don't want to be inferred or implied. We want to be unequivocably,
factual.
You know, given this right.
Yes.
Put it in writing. Because as long as you've got a justice like Scalia saying that he interprets it not to be there, then it's not there.
And it's not up, you can't uphold it in court, and therefore it doesn't exist. Listen,
exactly.
we only have a minute left, Eileen. I wonder if you could give us some idea of how the young students where you are right now are responding to your educating them about ERA.
They don't believe us. It's a real learning curve. They look at us like, oh, of course we do. And we're like, no, you don't.
Yeah.
And then we have three. It's a real education curve. But, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, we say educate to advocate. You know, once we educate someone, they become an advocate.
Yes.
And we, it's a learning curve. And I would suggest everyone go to our website, www.women-matter.org, and learn about the issue. We have 146 congressional co-sponsors, 35 Senate co-sponsors. Both senators from Virginia are on our bill. Sadly, we've got a lot of Democratic congresspersons on our bill, no Republicans yet. We need to let the Republicans know this is a bipartisan bill. When they say they support women, you know, this is a support women bill that every elected official should support, because it is basic constitutional civil rights.
Exactly. One more time, slowly, the website, and then we'll have to go.
www.women-matter.org and the dash matter.
Okay. Thank you so much, Eileen. I am so inspired by the fact that you're right there on the ground talking
right
to young
ground.
People and
yep.
telling them. And they all have the same reaction I had when I was first told. Oh, of course
right.
we already have. But you,
right. And we have a chapter at VCU now. We hope to get one. If any of your students from University of Virginia are listening, we would love to start a chapter at Virginia Commonwealth. We'd love to start a chapter at the University of Virginia. I have two daughters that graduated from the University of Virginia. We need UVA. We need the women at UVA and the men, because men should care about this issue.
Exactly.
They should care about this issue, because when you have a family someday, I would say to the undergrads, you want to make sure that your partner, if it's female, is not being underpaid, because that's going to affect the family's collective bottom line.
Exactly. We're going to have to end on that. This has been an incredible update. I so appreciate your being on the show, Eileen Davis, both RN nurse in Richmond, Virginia, and an advocate for the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, and an educator who goes out there and teaches all the young women who think they are equal constitutionally that know they need to advocate for that to happen. Thank you so much, Eileen, for being on the show. You got
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Bye now.
All right. Bye-bye.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. At the apex of the early Sundance days, Happy Texas caused a bidding war that ultimately led to a $10 million purchase price. Unfortunately, audiences for indies were still small, and getting word out for worthy films had not yet developed into a science. The distributors lost a fortune, damaging the power of indie films to emerge into the light, but not because this wasn't a very entertaining little film. Happy Texas is unapologetic comedy. Steve Zahn is Wayne, who with his partner in crime is on the lam from jail. The pair is mistaken for the gay producers of a children's beauty contest. So these straight shysters assume false identities, laying the groundwork for all manner of laughs. One highlight is Zahn teaching a room full of children to dance for the pageant show. Priceless. Completing a surprisingly accomplished cast for such a tight-budgeted indie, William H. Macy plays the town sheriff. There are precious few straight-out indie comedies. Indies usually deal with the difficult subjects, too heavy for Hollywood.
But comedic writers and actors need to find their start as well. And when the indie community sets out to make you laugh, it is well worth your time to let them take you on the road to Happy Texas.
Indie Film Minute. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us in becoming one of the reasonable voices heard around the world. Voter ID, MIA Surgeon General, Ebola Panic. Ebola is not worthy of our national panic button. However, NRA-dominated congressional conservatives blocking the nomination of Dr. Vivek Murthy as Surgeon General is grounds for alarm over low voter turnout in 2014. In America, Ebola has killed one man and wounded two nurses. But if we must panic, Alzheimer's, brain-robbing millions, is the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. Police shoot and kill more than Ebola, as do drunk drivers, texting teens, domestic violence, and airline crashes. But if panic is to be our new American pastime, on November 4th, vote for leaders who deactivate hyperlink between high school dropouts and privatized prisons. Vote knowing it was the board of a for-profit private hospital that voted no admittance for Thomas Duncan. If we must panic, choose more rational targets, like the oxidation of our brains by the greed of pharmaceutical pill-pushing companies that bombard reason with so much overstated and questionable advertising, we are Ebola distracted from what is really killing us. For example, sugar and diabetes, a K Street ALEC judiciously handicapping the elderly, university students, minorities, and our electoral system with voter ID laws. Obesity and malnutrition, failing to honor the physically and mentally wounded veteran with affordable health care as much as we memorialize war dead with monuments. Filibuster, congressional gridlock, government shutdown, and a 5-4 politicized Supreme Court. Sequestration, gouging NIH budget to find cures for disease. Ignorance of the facts and being too lazy to research for the truth. All forms of discrimination, prejudice, bias against those who look, think, preach, act, or marry differently than we. And finally, food corporations with advertising so bottom-line oriented, we are addicted to the very things that kill everything except our panic. Arguably, the aforementioned is corporatism's defining moment, and we define ourselves by how we allow corporate America to transform our eating, drinking, and election habits. Thus, we get the government we failed to vote for by leaving the choices to those who do. We get the government we are too issue misinformed about to cast justice for all ballots. We get the government we settle for because flag-waving and repeating Americans this slogans and family values that cliches are easier than committing daily acts of random constitutional spirit toward one another. Voting, like driving, loving, hating, and panicking, are choices and/or privileges, but not rights. Rights are what's guaranteed us in our U.S. Constitution. Unless we the people allow, through our inaction, our ignorance of history's revisionists, our knowledge of the dangers of redistricting, or just blissfully succumbing to the redirection of misinformation, settle for being subjugated by the repetitious re-election of supremacist-oriented conservatives, addicted to corporate money and political power, by the way, then on November 4th, 2014, we will honor those hungry, underpaid, and often shoeless original Americans who fought against tyranny even before there was an America. And we accomplish this by voting and helping others to vote, especially the elderly and college-age students. Then truly we will be the home of the brave and not the panicked. Let's strike a ballot blow for rational thought against media hype and defeat both political and Wall Street Madison Avenue corporate commercials that both brainwash and brain damage before we're all brain dead. With each vote, we can denounce the revolting, revolving door from Congress to corporatism's rewards. Let's not diminish ourselves with the irrelevance of right direction poll questions. Instead, let's renounce panic, let go of hype, and vote ourselves forward into fixing fixed voting machines, attending to our neglected infrastructure, sharing both affordable health care and voting privileges with truth and justice for all Americans. Now please visit thereasonablevoice.com website and listen to the episode of Charlottesville This Week entitled Ebola Facts Cancel Panic. You might also want to stop by our Blog Talk Radio podcasts for Alzheimer's Kills More Americans Than Ebola. Either way, join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard around the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of thereasonablevoice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard around the world.